This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 9 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, and of course it is here that we take a trip around the outer rim of the nostalgia mothership that was WCW. And to do that, I must pick up my partner for the voyage, as always, the chap called Alan. Alan, how are you, sir?
I'm great. I'm still been enjoying Chris Jericho's theme with lyrics that we discussed and what played us out on the last episode. Enjoying that on the ride home from work this evening. I didn't quite have a mullet with the wind blowing in my hair or anything like that to make it even better. But still, I enjoyed it nevertheless. So I'm excited for this show, episode 9 now, where we're going great guns. So shall we go straight into that plunder bucket?
I don't see any reason why we shouldn't, Alan. Let's dive right in for question number 1 inside that plunder bucket.
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Hello, guys. Love the show. I would like to know about the fabled curse of the Armstrongs that seemed to go on forever on WCW Saturday night. Larry Zbyszko mentioned it almost any time an Armstrong brother was in a match. When was the first mention of this on TV? Was it meant to be an actual storyline, or was it something Zbyszko came up with to be a jerk to the Armstrong brothers? Was the curse ever broken? And that's from Michael in Madison, Wisconsin via email. So thanks for the question, Michael. So the curse of the Armstrongs. I like things like this, JT, where it's something that's kind of there, but it's not really an angle as such, but it's still kind of mentioned. So I like these little touches to add to someone's character. So the whole curse of the Armstrong, do you know where it originated from?
I thought it had something to do with, I mean, Larry Zbyszko is the one who always mentioned it, like was called out in the email. And I thought it had something to do like with an actual angle, and then it just kind of spawned from there. But I mean, on the surface, I always believed it had to do with them just never rising above like low card status. I mean, was that the basis of it? That's what I always thought it was.
The absolute Armstrong curse, Zbyszko did coin the phrase, I believe. But what he was actually referencing was, he said anyway that years ago, Bullet Bob Armstrong, which is the head of the Armstrong clan, stole the tiny shrunken head that Abdullah the Butcher carried around on a stick. And because of that, Bob's offspring were forever cursed. And this was an angle on Georgia Championship Wrestling. So I can't actually find any footage of this angle. It would have been cool if I could have looked it up. But we'll take the research word for it. So that's pretty cool that they're playing off something that must have been, you know, referenced 10, if not more, years previous to this. So I think that's pretty cool. And I like little touches like that in wrestling. I was trying to think of others where things have been mentioned that occurred years earlier. And I know there was a time, talking of Georgia Championship Wrestling, there was Buck Robley. He got banned from TBS for life for an angle he did where he beat the hell out of Tommy Rich in the TBS studios. So that was referenced again, you know, years later in a different promotion, I think around 88 time. That was mentioned in Jerry Oates' promotion. So cool things like that. Another example that's off the top of my head was WrestleMania 3, where you had Adrian Adonis losing to Roddy Piper. And I know Gorilla Monsoon referenced that it was Jesse Ventura's old tag team partner, which was something from years previous in WWF, the East-West connection. It was maybe about 6 years removed. And for a lot of people in 87, they weren't the same fans. They'd grown, you know, hugely from more of a regional promotion to a national international promotion by 87. So referencing something from years previous is kind of like a cool touch. So I mean, I know Road Dogg as well has referenced this on WWF TV. He was spotted wearing a t-shirt that says "Look, Mom, no curse." on it, which I think was quite a clever little T-shirt to have, a little throwback to the whole Armstrong curse. So yeah, it is an actual thing. Did you hear it mentioned quite a lot on Saturday night when you were watching it at the time?
Yeah, I definitely remember them mentioning that often. I feel like even more and more as they went along, it came up quite a bit, like in the mid to late 90s, whenever he'd pop up, whether it was like Dusty or Bobby or whoever. I do feel like it definitely became a thing. And I want to say it even got used in an angle at some point. I feel like it was part of an angle. I don't remember the specifics. speaking to those other ideas, too, you had said like things, like random things that get brought up. Maybe this one's not random, but I feel like Hogan slamming Andre, like even when Hogan went to WCW, they'd always reference that a lot, whether it's in relation to Hogan or to the Giant, who at first, remember, was supposed to be Andre's son. So yeah. I think that was something that always got called back to. And then also, I guess it wasn't in the past, it was kind of recent, but it was really random. At WrestleMania 6, when Jesse Ventura calls Roddy Piper his tag team partner. Like, I doubt anyone in the world got it, but it was due to that pilot that they had taped for the sitcom, Piper and Jesse.
Yeah.
Tag team. So, he talks about that during his entrance. So that was kind of always one that slipped by me for many years until I realized what, you know, I found out what he was talking about. But, yeah, the curse thing is, it was definitely prevalent enough for me to pick up on it, even as someone that wasn't fully in the know, like, and didn't know about the curse. I just always assumed it was they're losers, you know. that was always kind of what it seemed like. So it didn't do them any favors to bring it up constantly, because it definitely made them feel like guys that just never won anything. And, oh, they're cursed, you know, they're never going to win. It was like the Red Sox or the Cubs or, you know, a team like that that's cursed.
Yeah, but I think in a way, though, it explains something, because they're always going to be there as enhancement talent. That's what their position was.
Right.
That's what they're always used as. So in a way, it gave a reason why they kept losing rather than they just lost. So yeah, they are deemed as losers. That's because they're not pushed. That's the role that they're playing. So at least it gives a little bit more to it. So I don't know in terms of how that would build to anything or it would make any sort of angle, but it's just a nice little touch. Like we said, there's things like that that kind of add to a character.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And then I remember too, Road Dogg, when he was in the WWF, and he really caught on finally with the Outlaws and broke the curse. I guess you could say he had the shirt that said "Look, Mom, no curse," which is a cool wink, wink to the Armstrong curse. And it took him a few years to get there in the WWF. He was you know suffering from the curse for a couple of years there, but when he finally broke through with the Outlaws, and they were known for doing kind of insider stuff on their shirts or, you know, promos or comments as part of DX, that was one that definitely wasn't super inside, but inside enough that it was good for a laugh.
Yeah, no, I like that touch as well. I mentioned that a minute ago myself. I think Brad Armstrong is the guy that is the most WCW of all the Armstrongs, arguably. Would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. Because the other ones are what? Steve, who was in the Young Pistols. Scott Armstrong, who didn't really do too much besides jobbing. And, of course, probably more known as a referee for WWE. And then, of course, I mean, Bullet Bob, obviously. But he doesn't really count for just counting the kids. So, yeah, I would say Brad is... in WCW, anyway, the most well-known, yeah.
Well, that's funnily enough, because I want to go through his gimmicks quickly he's had over the years, because old Brad has had quite a few, hasn't he, JT? All the way from when he debuted in the 80s, all the way up to the end of WCW, really. So I'm just going to go through a few of them quickly.
Okay.
One of my random ones was the one, I think it was around 91, this would have been, the Candyman gimmick. For some strange reason, WCW management thought it would be a great idea to have Armstrong come out to the ring in candy cane striped tights and throw candy to the fans. That was the essence of the gimmick. It was a whole playing to the kids type thing. This screams Jim Herd to me.
It was a really dumb gimmick. And when you first hear Candyman, I always thought, like, you know, just reading it in the magazines or seeing the name thrown about, I always assumed it was a playoff, like the horror guy, the Candyman. You know, you say his name or like whatever the... Was it a horror movie or was it a nursery rhyme? Whatever the fuck it was.
Well, you had to say Candyman three times and then he would come.
Right, yeah. That's what I thought it was always like a horror gimmick. You know what I mean? Like you say Candyman three times in the mirror and then he shows up in the mirror. So I always figured it was something like that where he was supposed to be like a ghoul or something. And then I actually saw it, when I saw it years later, I was like, oh God, it was literally just like fucking Willy Wonka throwing candy out on the streets, you know?
No, I think Brad's take on the gimmick was he hated the tights, and I don't blame him. Throwback to kind of Virgil tights, you know, the striped ones. But he was able to give tons of candy to the kids, and they loved that. So he liked that gimmick to a point. There was another gimmick that he had was the Fantasia Bad Street gimmick, where it was a mask gimmick where Brad would become a member of the WCW version of the Freebirds with PSAs, Jimmy Jam Garvin, and they were managed at the time by Big Daddy Dink, which was Oliver Humperdinck.
Mm-hmm.
He was initially known as Fantasia. But then in classic WCW, the feared legal action from Disney, so he's quickly, the name was changed to Bad Street. And what his take on it was, he loved this one because he could do anything as a heel. I didn't know he had that in him. He didn't know, sorry, he had that in him, but he put the mask on and he said, they can do what you want. So he really enjoyed that gimmick as well. So do you have any memories of that gimmick? Because it was short-lived, to be fair, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. It always felt like kind of forced to me. It reminded me of like Jimmy Jack Funk, the fake Funk brother with Terry and Haas. So it was always, whenever they had that third guy in the mask, you know, the cousin Oliver of the Brady Bunch that they jam into the team at the end, always feels like overkill. Especially, I mean, the mask thing is goofy, and I get why they'd want to get the hell away from Fantasia. I mean, why risk for such a loser gimmick? You know, why risk pissing off Disney, who you're kind of tied into? So I always thought it was funny they didn't just call him Bradstreet and make it obvious who it was. You know,
that's quite clever. but he went through a phase of wearing masks and being under the hood because he was also Arachnoman, which was a complete rip-off, as we know, of the Marvel Comics superhero Spider-Man.
Oh, big time.
It was bad, wasn't it? I mean, I watched a couple of the matches, and what he did as well, didn't he? Had the kind of string that came out, didn't he? It was like a mocking of Spider-Man at some point as well. It was real bad. The colours were just blue and yellow, weren't they? And he was just Brad Armstrong under a hood doing slightly more athletic manoeuvres to try and get the gimmick over than he would in his Brad Armstrong moniker.
It's lazy WCW in a way because, like, all right, you're on to something. Let's do a superhero, you know, masks, get over. We see it in Lucha and it's been done before. Like, okay, we're feeling it. Let's just make him a Spider-Man, clear Spider-Man knockoff. Like, I mean, just like a cheap imitation Spider-Man knockoff. I mean, it's just so, like, you get to the cusp of something good and then do something really stupid. Why not just try and make him, give him, like, a unique character that could have still got over him? You can make him, like, a superhero, something man, but why make it so obvious? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
this is the years before Arachnophobia as well, the movie. So it's ahead of its time, I guess. But yeah, no good.
Yeah, it was low rent, and Marvel Comics did have a problem with it, and they claimed there was an infringement of the Spider-Man patent and threatened legal action. So WCW again dropped that one. So they don't think things through under the Jim Herd era, as we well know, which we've documented before, which we'll go through in, you know, future episodes as well. Another gimmick, quickly, was the Dos Hombre gimmick, which is Brad and Ricky Steamboat under masks to be pretending to be a luchador tag team. So it's kind of mask, full body suit. That was what, one pay-per-view, I think, the Dos Hombres gimmick in 93, I'd say.
It wasn't supposed to be Shane Douglas, like, and they just stuck Armstrong in there, because wasn't it during when Steamboat and Douglas were feuding with the Blondes or something? I thought it was during that whole thing, and they were under the masks to trick them, and it ended up being that Douglas was gone already, so they just had to be Armstrong. It was something along those lines, I thought.
Yeah, it was something like that. It was at a clash. I think they had a cage match between the two teams at the time. So yeah, that was another one of the Brad Armstrong gimmicks. And the last two, which is later in WCW, so this is more your kind of wheelhouse, is the BA gimmick when he was signed by Master P to a big money contract. Awesome. Oh, no, he wasn't signed. Master P was signed to a big money contract.
Right, yes.
And the whole No Limit Soldier. So what's your memory of that gimmick and the Buzzkill gimmick as well, JT?
BA was just, it felt like, I mean, to me, it 100% felt like a ripoff of Road Dogg. I mean, that's all it was. Like, all right, Road Dogg's kind of doing the, you know, a little, you know, they did the army stuff with DX. He's got the fatigues on. He's kind of rapping and kind of being like a tough guy. Like, it just felt like a knockoff. Like, they were desperate trying to make him a knockoff of Road Dogg. And then Buzzkill would actually be a straight knockoff of Road Dogg later on, because they were just like, fuck it. And they have him with the tie-dye shirts and the dreads and everything. So, I mean, that was like, you know, that was a Vince Russo taking a direct shot at Road Dogg, but it was useless. I mean, the Buzzkill was worthless. And was he part of the, was he with like Mike Awesome too or something with the 70s guy? Or was he just, was this two separate burnout 70s gimmicks?
He was just had maybe two separate gimmicks. Yeah. I don't remember off the top of my head any allegiance between the two on screen. But he came out, didn't he, as Buzzkill with a placard saying, no bombs, no something.
Oh,
and
right,
I watched,
right,
it's a match on the playlist. And the name of the person he was wrestling was played into, it was No Something. So it wasn't, obviously it wasn't Adam Bomb that were playing to Bomb. It was a name like that. I've forgotten who it was. Oh, it was Tank. No Tanks. It was Tank Abbott. Tank Abbott just destroyed him in literally a minute. And that was
Buzzkill. Yeah, it was just another paint on a jobber.
No pain. much peace and love for Buzzkill. Talk about a contrast in style between Buzzkill and the Tank himself.
Well, he's not going to find any peace and love right now from this man, Tank Abbott.
At that point, and just a shot. You know, Russo did a lot of this shit in WCW. Took shots at former gimmicks that he had worked with or gotten over in WWF either. He would either do it as an attempt to prove he could do the same thing there or as a parody and a mock. And there's so much wrong with that Russo era, and this was like a good example of it. Just like no one's interested in WCW fans were interested in what he thought they wanted. And he thought everyone wanted to be inside the gimmick, taking jokes, talking smart, being on message boards. And like, it was just the wrong audience. Like, he should have just fucking went to ECW if he wanted to do that, you know? Like, WCW fan, their fan base was older and skewed more toward just like WCW. Like, they wanted their wrestling. They wanted WCW wrestling. And even if it got hot with like college kids for a while, they're probably going to fade anyway. But they also weren't super into it at that point. Just, that was such a small piece of the pie in 1999 that he was targeting. Nowadays, sure, everyone's on the internet, you know, like there's a whole bunch more people that would probably appreciate some of that stuff, but at that time it was so targeted to such a small audience. And it was just I can't even imagine just being a general WCW fan that wasn't really inside and seeing some of the shit and wondering like what the fuck it was. Like, it doesn't surprise me that they hemorrhaged viewers so quickly, because people probably just were watching Thunder and like, what is, I don't understand any of this, you know, and just like turned it off because it's so confusing all of a sudden with all these guys taking, you know, shots and talking inside and talking about what's going on backstage and, you know, reality. It's just, it was just such a miss overall. And you know, not to go off on the tangent that I've gotten on, but BA just, it just, and Buzzkill, I mean, just made me think of that. But BA was stupid too. I mean, the No Limit Soldiers, he just wasn't a fit. Like, it just, yeah, I know they did it so they could have a worker in the group, but it was just miscast.
There's no question that this trio, B.A., Swole, and 4x4, that's a group to be reckoned with here in World Championship Wrestling.
Yeah, completely. And getting to the whole Russo era, the WCW, just the vibe of the whole promotion changed. And that's something we can touch on in a later episode if someone kind of asks the questions on kind of the aesthetics of WCW in general, because that'd be quite a cool one to go through. Just before we go to the next question, did you hear Jim Cornette's promo about Vince Russo challenging him to an actual fight?
I saw that it happened. I did not hear it yet.
No, it's worth going out of the way to listen to. It's slightly, it's a good promo. I don't know. It's very slightly close to the bone, though. Really, it's real. He just basically wants to challenge him. No one's there. No guns. No knives. $5,000. If Russo can take it off Cornette, he can have it. Jim Cornette will turn up at any address that Russo says, and it's a bit weird, really. That's all I can really say on that one. I think it could turn into an angle, but then I know Jim Cornette doesn't like him, so I just really don't think he's going to go against his principles on this one. But yeah,
right when Cornette seemed to be stabilizing a bit, like he came back to WWE, did the table for three, did the Hall of Fame. He was kind of getting his feet back under, you know, like, I don't know. Everyone seemed to kind of be like, all right, maybe Cornette's like calmed down just a little bit and he's going to do a few more things to WWE. Then he goes into shit like this still. It's like, who cares? Like, I'd rather see him just, I'm done with the shoots and the rants and all that. Like, we've seen it. Been there, done that. We've heard him talk about it. I think he has more value to just, like, fucking just be on Dirty Network and do stuff. Like, I want to hear that side of Jim Cornette. Like, he gave the speech he gave with the Rock and Roll Express to the Hall of Fame. Like, that was great. The Table for Three is great. Like, more of that. You know, less of this nonsensical old man rambling that just makes you hate him, you know? Like, I'm all set with that shit.
Yeah, so, yeah, we're completely gone off topic there. So, shall we move on to the second question?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, and this is, what was wrong with WCW security in 96 to 98? It seems like every other Nitro had at least one fan jumping the barricade. The best example is 1997 Halloween Havoc. After the main event, a fan climbs the cage, gets over it, and gets the shit kicked out of him by Hogan and Savage. Was this a plan to an actual fan? The announcers had no idea how to react. Love the new show. And that's from Rab Everett via email. So thank you very much for the question there, Rab. I went back and watched this. Looking back at it, to me, completely looked like a work. I mean, Hogan was throwing work punches at the guy, but just to set the scene, giant WCW cage, slightly bigger than the old blue bar WWF cages. I think it might have been in one of the old Thunderdome cages, or it looked similar to one anyway.
They had it. It was almost like a knockoff. Oh, I mean, I don't know if Hell in a Cell had happened yet. I forget if they were before or not, but it was similar to that, where you had the room on the floor. It was around the floor as well.
Yeah, it was definitely a big occasion than what they'd used in the past. But yeah, the fan climbs over the cage when Piper's handcuffed and tied to the cage where Savage and Hogan are in there. Fan comes in, Hogan and Savage take him down. Hogan's work punching him while Savage is holding him. It's all a bit hokey, really, for me. But that set, like the question that was asked by Robert, kind of dangerous trend. There was a lot of the time.
Yes.
Is that a fan? What is
yes.
this?
Yes, it is. Over the top.
A fan has come in. Holy moly. What in the world is this guy doing?
Boy, I'll tell you what, it's broke loose here, guys.
It really
is. It has broke loose. This crowd is irate. They are standing around this building.
Roddy Piper, absolutely helpless. This fan is now paying the price to what should never, ever happen.
Should never left his seat.
I'm going to tell you what, guys. This thing.
Hogan, right now, Hollywood Hogan and Savage are beating up a fan. They are beating up one of the fans.
That's Doug Dillinger, head of security.
They got to get this kid
they
out
got
of
it,
here.
Yeah. Well, he shouldn't have got in there in the first place.
I understand.
I mean,
that.
You know what? I mean, what are you talking about?
But Hook, he's beating up a fan. This fan wanted to save Piper. I mean, this is bedlam. And now security is trying to save this fan's life. That's all they're trying to do here.
What a scene we have here. What a scene here. In Las Vegas, right here in the desert, guys.
We didn't expect.
Where's Piper? Where is Piper still?
In WWF and WCW, all these kind of fans hopping the rail legitimately, and you had the security guards trying to take them down, or in some cases, the referees. There was the famous one as well, and I've put all these in the playlist, where Raven, do you remember the one with Raven, where he's getting his hair pulled, he's sat in the corner doing the Raven kind of sitting in the corner gimmick, and that kind of turned wrong. I don't know how the fan could get there before security on that one. That was out the blue, really.
That was a scary one, because Raven had no way to protect himself, and the guy actually pulls him to the floor through the ropes when he's sitting in the corner. I mean, that's one of the most dangerous ones I've seen. The guy Raven had no chance, like, to do anything. And, you know, when he got yanked from behind, because at first he's probably thinking, like, I got to think it's not going through your head as it's a fan, right? When you can't see like that, maybe he thought it was like an angle or a wrestler coming out and, you know, a fight's going to happen and something he forgot about, or that they're shooting. Yeah, like, who knows? Like, I doubt you're thinking a fan is grabbing my hair like that. But anyway, that was a scary one. There's been some really crazy ones. These WCW ones were nuts. I mean, it definitely became an issue, and they definitely didn't help themselves when they had to be at work the first time. And from there, it was just on. I mean, it was just on. Like, it happened constantly. And I think a part of it, too, that era of Nitro, and I kind of hinted at this a minute ago, their fan base was very much aimed at drunk college frat boys, right? I mean, that was a Nitro party. And if you look at the crowd on Nitro, there's always big groups of guys, like, hammered, you know, like, so, I mean, you're likely to get more and more of that, like a football game or a college game or something, where people are just going to come out of the crowd. I mean, you start gaining mainstream popularity, it starts to become more and more like a sporting event. You're going to get drunk assholes that think they can just come out there and do what they want. I mean, you know, even with them getting the shit kicked out of them by wrestlers and referees, didn't seem to ever deter.
No, and I think it ruined some angles as well. There was an angle on December the 15th, 97 Nitro, where Bischoff is audibly swearing over the air. I think they've edited that off the network. So as Sting was doing his lights out and appearing in different parts of the building at with the NWO in the ring, when they did the final lights out, a fan hit the ring. The lights come on and Sting is standing on top of the Nitro set. He was supposed to hit the ring and start fighting the NWO, but so many fans were hitting the ring, the angle completely got messed up to the point where the show went off air with Sting slowly pacing towards the ring, and nothing happened because the edge is completely gone from the scene because of all the fans are there.
Right.
So it completely ruined the angle, and that must have been enough for WCW, because they did have more in the future, but it was, the security seemed to be a little bit tighter from that point.
And there's some guys that always seem like more anxious to beat the shit out of the fans. Like Savage was one that would just lay into people. I mean, even the worked one, but even there's one, another one, Savage later, that it's not worked, and he just like mauls a guy. Hall and Nash do the same thing. But one of my favorites is with a referee. Was it was it Mickey J who does it?
I think it's Pee Wee Anderson.
Oh, Pee Wee Anderson, you're right. The guy comes in and like Anderson is fucking. I mean, he really, really beats on him and messes with him.
Yeah, no, but he would have got respect from the boys for that one. His only small man was Pee Wee. But yeah, I think not a good idea to hit the ring. Do you remember the most recent one was a few years ago? I think it might have been on the European tour. It was a house show. It wasn't a main TV thing, I don't think, where four fans hit the ring and started running the ropes and having a match in the ring. It was on the internet at the time, a couple of years ago maybe. That was the one that's most recent. But yeah, it's not a good idea to hit the ring, is it? I mean, at that point, you're fair game for whatever you get. I don't know nowadays, though. If you went and over the guardrail, you got really seriously injured by a wrestler, do you think there still could be a lawsuit? Because is there any waiver that's signed? There isn't one, a written one, obviously, when you buy a ticket. It's just an understanding. But really, if you got injured, do you think, you know, even though it was you that invaded the space, but if the wrestler took it too far, you'd have a case?
No, I don't know. It's tough to say. I feel like it's not part of the ticket, but it's got to be. I mean, it has to be somewhere in the policy, like at the arena, right? It's probably posted somewhere. I think announcers usually say it like in the beginning. Like, you know, if you enter the ringside area, at least they used to, where they say if you enter the ringside area. They definitely say it now when you go, actually. It's a pre-recorded announcement they put up on the board. It's like, you know, fans that throw stuff or enter are subject to being thrown out or escorted out. There's a warning message that's put out there. I mean, I don't know. I've seen it in baseball games. Guys rush the field and you know, get their asses kicked by security and dragged out. And I've never heard of anyone suing or...
Yeah, but that's security. That's the difference. It's like any sporting event. Yeah, if you rush the field of play, you're going to get taken out by a steward or security. But
well, there's been football players, too, that have, I think, taken guys down or whatever. But, I think that the wrestler could say, I felt endangered. I'm out here with nothing to protect me. I don't know if he's got a weapon. I'm just trying to take him down. And, you know, I think there's so much gray area that if a guy is drunk and comes out there for no reason, I think it'd be a real hard case unless you could prove that these guys went overboard and security watched while they beat the shit out of him or something. You know what I mean? Like something like that. It'd have to be a real outlier, I think.
Yeah, no, I think, it would be really just thinking about it. But, yeah, don't rush the ring, as I said, guys. But, yeah, there's some good examples. They're all on the playlist there. You should check them out. So hopefully that answers the question for Rab. So shall I go and warm my car up?
I think so. So hop in your car, Alan, because as we do each and every week, it is time for the 1-800-COLLECT-ROAD-REPORT, looking back at this week in WCW history with the chap they call Alan.
Hello.
Tony, actually, I got a Nitro party that's on the move. We started in Atlantic Beach. I'm now in Neptune Beach, and I promised to make a quick stop at a Nitro party at the University of North Florida. So hold on, guys. Hey, did you guys hear what happened here yesterday in Florida?
No, what was that?
It was Ground Weasel Day. Yeah, Punxsutawney Bobby stuck his head out of his condo, saw a shadow, so we're going to have 6 more weeks of bad taste. That's your 1-800-COLLECT-ROAD-REPORT from Jacksonville. I'm Lee Marshall for 1-800-COLLECT.
Okay, so we are in Norfolk, Virginia this time. We're at WCW Clash of the Champions 23. And this was the show with the noted for the in-ring return of Ric Flair, mm-hmm. who'd come to WCW a few months earlier, doing the whole Flair for the Gold stuff. And he had to sit out due to a non-compete clause. So this was his first time back. And it was a match. It was the Four Horsemen versus the Hollywood Blondes. And this... What do you think of the match? I mean, the Horsemen went over the Blondes 2-0. It was best of three falls match for the WCW in the NWA World Tag titles. But as the second fall was won by DQ, the championship did not change hands. So I don't know about that as a kind of screwy finish, but what do you, your memories of this match? Do you think it was a good match?
I feel like it was kind of disappointing. I mean, I very much remember watching this show at the time and being pretty hyped. I was a really pretty big Ric Flair fan, especially from coming off his WWF run. I was really upset when he left and went back to WCW, but I was pretty pumped for his in-ring return because I'd been hyped for a bit. Of course, he had the no-compete clause, so he couldn't wrestle for a while. And they really pumped this clash up for his in-ring return. And I loved the Blondes, so on paper, it looked like it was going to be like epic to me at the time, you know? And I feel like it comes up short of that. I feel like it's a fine TV match, but not what it probably could or should have been. And I get it. Maybe Flair had some rust or whatever. It's funny because on the most recent Jeff Learns Wrestling, he asked me if any best of three falls ever end in two. And I listed off a couple. I forgot about this one too. But I'm not a huge fan of the two straight falls in a match like this. the Blondes were still, I mean, they were champions. They were heavily pushed, and it kind of makes them look shitty to lose two straight. I know the second one's by DQ, but it's like, why not just do a one fall match and have them get DQ'd? You know, it just, it felt like, okay, they get to beat them once, and then the Blondes barely escape with the belt. So I wasn't a huge fan of it. I mean, it's cool that Flair's back in the ring, but it's not like a favorite of mine.
Yeah, I mean, the show, the card itself was quite a varied card. I mean, we had the dark match pre-show. We had Jim Neidhart over Shanghai Pierce. In the opening, we had Ron Simmons defeating Dick Slater. And then we had Stephen Regal defeating Marcus Alexander Bagwell. Max Payne over Johnny B. Bavaya forfeit, which we've touched on in a previous episode. We had Barry Windham defeating Tuco Scorpio to retain the NWA World Heavyweight title, which... think that was an all right match from memory. I've not watched that in a number of years now.
No, that's a solid match. I mean, Wyndham, this was like, I mean, he is legit on fumes here, right? Because I think he was back from the knee injury. He has like an okay match with Flair. Yeah, I mean, he's running low on gas at this point. And then he comes back again for that one match in 94 against Flair, and it's like super sad.
He's totally out of shape at this point, isn't he?
Yeah, it's not the same. But he does dial it up for this match a little bit. This one's probably one of his better ones during this time frame.
Well, yeah, but Tuco Scorpio, one of the best talents of the 90s. In general, I think up to 96, he may have been one of the best workers in the world. He was, you know, good from the start of his WCW run into his ECW run, and then unfortunately, he's saddled with the Flash Funk gimmick, and it didn't really happen for him much after that. He went over to Japan, All Japan, and places like that, and he did have some more success there. But in the middle of the 90s, Tuco Scorpio was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And in the semi-main event, we had Big Van Vader, Rick Rude, and Sid. There's a great three-man team, heel team. They went over and beat David Boy Smith, Dustin Rhodes, and Sting.
Another great team.
That was quite a loaded match there. I'd enjoyed the whole show, this clash. I think the clashes in 93, I'm trying to think of any others that kind of stand out to me at the moment. This may be the best one of the ones in 93, unless it's something that I'm obviously missing.
Well, there's one with... Doesn't Flair fight Vader on one to set up Starrcade? I think it's toward the end of the year.
Yeah, it was. Looks like the Starrcade match was obviously the December show, December 27th.
It was November, November 10th. Flair beat Vader by DQ, and that would eventually lead to Starrcade. That was a fun match, and then that one had Austin versus Pillman, Regal versus Bad. The one before in August too had Vader versus Davey Boy, and they had really good chemistry. They had some stiff matches, Vader and Bulldog. So that's not a bad one either. And that has the it's kind of a guilty pleasure match of mine: Sting and Ric Flair versus the Kongs, the Colossal Kongs.
I don't know, whatever.
I like those big fat jobber, big fat monsters that get beat up by guys. I don't know.
Managed by Harley Race, I believe, at the time as well. The Clash of the Champions in general, 2-hour shows, they fly by, really. They're very akin now to, say, maybe an NXT TakeOver show, in the way that there's a nice bit of variety. We're not loaded with, 20 matches. Matches are given time to percolate, if you will. On this show, there was 6 matches in the 2 hours. So, there's plenty of time for people to kind of show their stuff. So, if people want to go back, I'd definitely recommend just any Clash of the Champions, really. Mm-hmm. You're always going to find something in there that you'll enjoy.
Yep.
So, I'm going to go on now to our final question on this show, the long-form question. And this is talking about Battle Balls, which I'm was a big fan of, maybe for the wrong reasons, right. But I was a big fan. So, we'll get to the question. So, what was your opinion on the Battle Ball concept in general, and should they have tried it during the NWO era? And that's from Lawrence Miles on Twitter. So, thank you very much for the question there, Lawrence. So, Battle Balls, we had a number over the years in WCW, the first one being at Starrcade in 91, which is 2-ring Battle Royal. We went on and we had the one in 92 at Starrcade as well, I believe. And we had the Battle Bowl in 93, which is his own pay-per-view. And finally, we had a Battle Bowl kind of gimmick in 96, didn't we, at the Slamboree pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
So, first bit of the question, what are your memories of Battle Bowls in general? Have you got any of your favourites, anything that stands out to you in the Battle Bowls? And do you want to explain the Battle Bowl concept in general as well?
Yeah, we can explain the concept first, and then I'll talk about some memories. So it's a 2-ring battle royal. Wrestlers start in one ring and try and throw wrestlers into the other ring. And once they get to that second ring, that's where they can be eliminated from. The last remaining wrestler in the first ring rests until there's only one left in the second ring. And then they go at it to determine who will be the champion. And, of course, entry into the Battle Bowl meant you had won a tag team match earlier in the night. So, basically, they would have a drawing with random pairings. These teams would all team up in a round robin. Well, not even a round robin, right? It was a single elimination early on.
Yeah,
it was a double, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, it was single elimination, but I mean, early on you had to win, I think, like two rounds to move on. And then in 96, you just had to win one match, I think, to advance. But anyway, all the winners of the tag matches got thrown into the Battle Royal. So you had to survive the tag tournament, and then you had to win the Battle Royal to win the whole Battle Bowl concept. I remember as a kid, it seemed really cool. Like, I used to always scour the video stores looking for Battle Bowl. Like, to me, it seemed really, really cool, the idea of it. It was different. At that time of wrestling, you were, like, kind of hungry for anything that stood out differently like this, because it was kind of rare. Like, Survivor Series at that time was awesome because it was just different, you know, it was just different from anything else. And that's why the Royal Rumble, I think, caught on so much. And so this seemed neat. It was random pairings, which is cool. And then a big battle royal with everyone in execution.
Yeah, you'd see matches you'd never seen before as well. That was an interesting thing. There was teams that would never team together. You had faces and a heel on one side versus a face and a heel on the other side, or three heels and then there's only one face on one side. So there was lots of things that could be done with it. And it was different. You enjoyed the Survivor Series, the Royal Rumble. I had quite a fetish for battle royals in general. Mm-hmm. I made someone make me a 5-hour battle royal compilation of WWF battle royals throughout the years, and it was an arduous task for them. I think they charged me an arm and a leg for doing it, because it was just, they weren't a fan of battle royals whatsoever. But I really dug them. And, you know, one of my first tapes that I purchased, WCW tapes, was the Starrcade 91. So, yeah, I was a big fan of the concept.
I guess you could have worse fetishes that you spend a lot of money on, but this is one. That's one of the most unique. A Battle Royal compilation. At the time, it was a unique thing. But in execution, it to me, it rarely worked. Like, I went back and rewatched a lot of these over the last few years, and watching all the WCW stuff in order. And a lot of them are rough to get through. Like, that Battle Bowl, the one that's actual, the pay-per-view, is it 91, where it's just a standalone, is it's a tough one to get through. Was it 91 or 92?
91 was the one that was on its own as a standalone one was the Battle Bowl 93.
That's right.
And that's the one we had guys like, you know, like you mentioned the Awesome Kongs before, you had guys like that. You had Shanghai Pierce, Shockmaster. That was the weakest one out of the four that they did, really, as a Battle Bowl concept, in my opinion.
And that year, you just had to win the one. So am I wrong on that? Was it always just you had to win one match and you advance? I thought there was a year where they hit you had to win two matches, but maybe not. So this one in 93, yes, you just had to win one round, and then you know, if you won your first tag match, you moved into the Battle Royal. So there were 8 matches, and then 16 men advanced to the Battle Royal. And that one is a fucking slog to get through that show. That is a rough show. I mean, the concept is different and unique, like I said, but watching it back, it's like you're dying for like a singles title match to get thrown in the middle of this thing. You know, it's just these random tag matches with very little stakes on the line just felt very blah after a while, especially when you're watching the Cole twins and these other guys go out there. It, you know, Rip Rogers was in that one, and I think it's a fun one, right? Doesn't he get the shit kicked out of him before the match, and then he's like, they win, and he comes into the Battle Royal, and he's like,
he's selling massively, yeah, like he's, yeah. But Rip Rogers on a pay per view in '93, just in WCW, is just really random. It just shows WCW really didn't have a depth in the roster at that point.
Yeah, it was, It was not the best roster for that. You're right. It was very shallow, not very deep. And you can see it by the matches they had to have. So 91 was the year it was in Starrcade. Yeah, that. How did you feel about them using Starrcade for it?
91, they were just throwing anything at the wall at that point. Mm-hmm. I think to try and compete. I don't think it really mattered what they put on what show, because WCW was really struggling at this point. So it was different. I don't blame them in the way they wanted to do something different. They did something different. I mean, I'm just going to touch on now the guys that were in the actual Battle Bowl, Battle Royals on the three, you know, consecutive years that they had them, the two Starrcades, 91, 92, and the Battle Bowl on its own. So the one in 91, we had Vader, Bagwell, Jimmy Garvin, Dustin Rhodes, Bill Kazmaier, Jushin Liger, Steve Austin, Richard Morton, Todd Champion, Abby, Firebreaker Chip, Thomas Rich, Ron Simmons, Ricky Steamboat, Mr. Hughes, Scott Steiner, Lex Luger, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, and Sting. So it's loads at the back end there that I mentioned, but that's random people like Bill Kazmaier, had a cup of coffee with WCW, was like one of the world's strongest man kind of gimmicks that he had. But Jushin Liger in there, which was, it was different. We had guys there like Richard Morton, Thomas Rich. They were just playing, you know, heel gimmicks at the time. You had Todd Champion, Firebreaker Chip. They were kind of low-end WCW talent in 91.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was, not the best, you know, not the best mix of guys. And I get it. I mean, you look at any Royal Rumble, it's the same way, right? I mean, you got guys at the back end that are just never in contention, and you could argue that it's a cool opportunity for some of these guys, and it gives you an easy out to have, you know, guys that can job, in these tag matches as well. They can eat the pin, and it makes things a little bit more obvious. To me, one of the worst offenders, and I guess, do you want to go in order on these? Because I wanted to talk about the last one, but if you wanted to, did you want to read through the
No, just jump in.
So the 96 one, to me, was probably the worst offending Battle Bowl that there was. So that was Slamboree it happened at, and they brought it back after a couple of years being off, and it felt so empty, I guess, the matches they had, but it also felt so rigged. Like, so here are the matchups in this one. You have Animal and Booker fight Hawk and Luger. Like, okay, Animal versus Hawk, right? The Public Enemy defeat Chris Benoit, the Taskmaster. Oh, these bitter enemies got teamed up. Rick Steiner and the Booty Man defeated Pittman and Scott Steiner. Oh, the Steiners went at it. VK Wall Street and Jim Duggan defeated the Blue Bloods. Oh, you know, heated rivals Wall Street and Duggan teamed up. Dick Slater and Earl Robert Eaton fought the Disco Inferno and Alex Wright. Okay, fine.
Odd couple, Dick Slater and Earl.
Oh, right,
Robert
that too. DDP and Barbarian beat Ming and Hugh Morris. Okay, so we're putting the dungeon against each other. You know, Fire and Ice, oh, they happen to team up against Big Bo and Stevie Ray. And then here's one. Ric Flair and Randy Savage defeated Arn Anderson and Eddie Guerrero. Okay, so Flair and Savage happened to end up each other? It's just, God, it felt so, it just felt so weird. And then they had a couple extra matches. Dick Slater and Eaton beat Wall Street and Duggan, and the DDP and Barbarian beat Steiner and Booty Man. So it's like some teams advanced right in and some had a fight again. So I don't know if they had qualifying matches where some teams had already won twice. Like, the whole thing is very confusing. So it ends up only being 8 men in the Battle Royal instead of 16 or 20 like it used to be.
They had Scott Norton, Ice Train, Dick Slater, Robert Eaton, DDP, Barbarian, Rocco, Rock, and Johnny Grunge.
Awful.
No star power there.
And it works for DDP because he ends up getting the Battle Bowl ring, and that kind of becomes like a thing for him for a bit, and then he puts it on the line in certain matches. So it gave him a gimmick, but I mean, they could have given him something. But this was like an example of what I said they could have done in 93. We have a Cruiserweight Championship match, Dean Malenko and our buddy Brad Armstrong. We have a U.S. title match, Conan and Jushin Liger, and then Giant versus Sting for the world title. So they mixed in some other stuff, which I thought worked well. You know, on the back end, a lot of the tag matches ended up being short because of the extra time, but it helped break up the flow of just having the tag matches.
Yeah, just go back to 91. 91 was won by Sting. It was him and Luger at the end. 92 was won by, I think it was Great Muta, and that was to set up Muta versus Wyndham at Super Bowl because they were the final two for the NWA title. The 93 one, I can't remember who won the 93 one. Was it Sting?
No, it was Vader.
Oh, Vader won that one.
Yeah, Vader eliminated Sting last.
Yeah. And then the 96 one was the DDP one, which you mentioned. But apparently as well as winning the Battle Ball ring, he was promised a title match, and he didn't actually get that for 2 years. He did it for the world title. He had a world title match at Halloween Havoc in 98. And to actually get that title match, he had to win War Games in 98 to begin with. So they didn't follow up on the stipulation with him winning the Battle Ball to get a title shot in 96.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that happened a lot in that era. Didn't Scott Hall won World War III in like 97 and then didn't get the title shot for like 2 years or so, or never got it? Yeah. It was something weird like that. And speaking of World War III, I was gonna bring that up as well, because I feel like that, you know, the person who asked the question said, why didn't they do it anymore? Well, I think partially it was replaced by World War III in a way, because that became the big Battle Royal event. Like, how many Battle Royal events are you gonna have? And in 96, they had two with Battle Bowl and then that. And I think World War III just became their modern version of Battle Bowl.
Yeah, World War III, on paper, you might think it's cool. 60 men, yeah, who are the guys? We're going to have all these different guys that we're going to use. But we're really scraping the barrel with your hard work. Bobby Walkers, Mike Enoses, even people kind of lesser known than that in some ways on these shows. And it was weird to watch. I mean, the actual three-ring Battle Royal, really a nightmare. You're watching one thing, but in the corner you had something else happening, but you could see three things happening on the main screen. And it was a kind of big jumble up until, you know, there's only 10, 15 guys left. Then, you know, you'd kind of be able to watch it all and see all the things that happened. But before that, it was a complete mess for the live audience, because how the ringside was, you know, configured, because there was three rings, it didn't really work for me. It was a bit clunky.
Yeah. It was another thing to me that was like, it really enticed me to want to watch it, but I agree with you. It was really clunky. The camera work, like I said, was shaky. It was hard to follow. All the jobbers kind of, you know, made it like, ugh. But in a way, again, it was during a time period where fresh stuff was appreciated. So it, like, to me, it was always a hook, and it was a, you know, at a time period where I had very little tapes to throw in, like, randomly. Like, World War III 95 was one I'd throw in quite a bit because it was just different. It was something different to watch. So, again, I always give WCW credit for going outside the box and trying a lot of different stuff. We've talked about it, and we'll talk about more. To me, that was one of the best parts about WCW. For a promotion that did have a lot of blunders and mistakes, they always were very open to trying something new and giving stuff a whirl. So I always gave them credit for that. Like, make a difference, stand out, and they did a lot of that until Vince Russo came and ruined everything.
Boo Russo. So that hopefully answers that question there for Lawrence, and we're going to wrap the show up now. So what plugs have you got? Because I'm just going to actually mention, JT, that I did listen to the podcast you do with your pal Jeff. Jeff, what's the show called again?
Jeff Learns Wrestling. But we tried to keep it as simple and to the point. And I feel like that's been a big part of the success of it. It's like, it's a real simple concept. You see it and you understand right away what the show's about.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. I listened to most of episode 3. I jumped in there. I'm going to go back and listen to 1 and 2. But it's really interesting to see fresh eyes take on things like the NWA, the studio format, versus a guy that had only been exposed to, and only in a small way as well, the WWF production. His takeaways from the difference in production was really eye-opening, because us as fans who've been, you know, indoctrinated to it and been watching it for years and years, you know, don't sometimes see the wood for the trees. Whereas a fresh set of eyes really makes you think about some certain points and how things that really we assume make sense to someone who's just new to it doesn't make sense at all. So yeah, it's a really good show. So I implore people to go and listen to the, you know, episode 3. Is that the latest one that's out still, JT?
Yeah, episode 3 just dropped. We're doing episode 4 the beginning of actually no, it would have been out already as well by the time when this airs. So yeah, usually the first 4 should be live on PlayStation.com. And he is a I mean, when I say he's a clean slate, like you said, Alan, like, I thought this would be easy for me and tough for him. It's been just as hard for me because he'll ask me these questions that have just been intuitive to me for so many years. And I'm like, oh, shit, how do I explain this? You know, it's like, I mean, the first episode, I'm like, do you know what a heel and face is? And he's like, no. So, I mean, I had to start with, like, explaining that. It's the stuff I thought maybe he would at least have a cursory knowledge of. But
yeah,
but he doesn't. And what I think is cool, too, and this was called out by a couple of the posters over at PWO, is he's taking this on with like a great attitude, and he wants to be a fan and like it. So he's not looking at it as someone that's coming in with a negative lens that I'm trying to convince to like wrestling and why it's good. He wants to be part of it. He wants to know, you know, this all came about because he felt left out that I didn't include him in being like part of our group of fans in high school and watching wrestling. He thinks he would have liked it. He's a big, you learn about this if you listen to episode 1, big soap opera fan. You know what I mean? So like he gravitates toward the characters and the stories and everything about it. And I've tried to like the last couple of years show him matches here and there. And finally I said, why don't we just do this the right way? And I'll just break you in as a fan and make up for all these years that we could have been watching wrestling together. So it's been cool that he wants to like it so much. And I think that's infectious, that he's looking at it through child eyes, but also someone that wants, you know, really badly to really get into it and like it. So I think it's cool in that regard that you're not getting someone that's just like shitting on it. Now, that said, he does poke holes in a lot of the inanity that's out there in wrestling. You know, he's calling out stuff that's absurd, but it's good because it's good observations. So yeah, you know, check it out. It's not on a regular schedule, but it will be dropping, I would say, within at least every 2 to 2.5 weeks. We're going to try and do an episode. And after the first episode, we started with the Mega Powers angle, but now we're going back and starting chronologically. So we're going to encompass all, you know, the major stuff, WWF, WCW / NWA, ECW, and then probably do spotlights here and there as he gains more and more knowledge. Go back and do like a special show on, like, he really wants to do the Andy Kaufman stuff. So like, go back and just do an episode all around Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler and stuff like that. Once he gets the real knowledge base down that we can jump around. So a lot of words there, but I love doing the show. It's got a lot of great feedback, and I thank everyone who's listened to it and keep listening.
Yeah, no, definitely. Guys should check it out. I enjoyed listening to episode 3. So you can send questions in, and this is the whole idea of the show, guys, into our plunder bucket. Best way to do that is either via Twitter. You can tweet them at Alan_CheapShot. That's A-L-L-A-N. And also place 2, the number 2, B-E Nation. Send them the questions in that way. Or you can send longer ones in if you want to email us, lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com. Send them through that way, and we'll get to them in a future episode. So thank you so much for listening, guys. I'm JT, and have you got anything final to say before we wrap things up?
That's it. If you're shopping with us, placementnation.com/Amazon is the route you should go. And, of course, follow us on iTunes, subscribe to all of our feeds, rate us, and leave feedback. Pro Wrestling Only, Placement Nation Wrestling, Placement Nation Pop. Check back each and every day, placementnation.com. We have a full index of all of our written and audio pieces for you to enjoy. I want to thank you for all of your support out there, and I cannot wait to get back in the saddle, back into the mothership next week to explore more WCW nostalgia. Until then, everyone take care. We're out.
Adios.
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo!
At the Mauler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dahl.
What I've heard.
What's up, shit, no softball game?
Light Magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
All right, the Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's a guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot!
You red-headed booger, you!
Is it spread?
Yes.
You can't find your scissors? Wow!